Okay, so what I'm going to present today is an overview of a chapter that I'm revising right now. And this is part of a broader project on colonial cities. And in this chapter, I explore the space of the Black Town by asking this very basic question of what was the significance of the Black Town in a colonial city? Why did it take shape? And what was the meaning, the social significance of the Black Town in a colonial city? Now, the space of my research is the colonial city of Calcutta, which is often regarded as the bridgehead of the British Empire in India. Now, this is a very recent map of India with Calcutta marked as Kolkata, which actually points to the rise of post-colonial ethnic nationalism in India after 1947, which renamed the city into Kolkata as a part of the broader nationalist venture. But during the time when I'm looking into the city, it was known as Calcutta. And it was the center of a very prosperous trade with South China, even before the British arrived. And what the British East India Company did is that it basically monopolized the trade routes in the Indian Ocean region. Now, prior to the British arrive, the region of Calcutta was basically three villages along a river. And the British made it into this port city of Calcutta. Now, colonialism, as I understand, was an early form of capitalism that produced new spaces of the city, which differed widely. The spaces of these cities in regions like South Asia, it differed widely from the industrial cities of the West. And a lot of scholarship already exists on the space of colonial cities. For instance, Gwendolyn Wright's work on colonial Algiers or Brenda Yeo's work on Singapore. Now, all of these works have explored the colonial city as a space which embodied racial segregation. So they have studied the city as actual space. Now, a lot of literature also exists on colonial Calcutta, which have been done by social historians who look into the space of the markets in the native or the Indian parts of the city. And these works have also explored the colonial city as actual physical space. Now, existing scholarship is unanimous in describing the Black Town as actual physical space where spatial order different from the European parts of the city prevail. Exploring the town plans of these spaces, historians have pointed to conflicts and negotiations that crafted space. Now, my paper really moves away from describing the Black Town as actual physical space to describing it as a colonial appropriation of native space. So in other words, what I'm going to argue in this paper is that the Black Town is actually different from the native town. While the native town is the actual physical space inhabited by the indigenous population, the Black Town was a product of a symbolic geography that represented native space as a culture of pathology. So if we can imagine a space that embodies a culture of disease or pathology, that is what I'm mapping as the Black Town. I will argue that the Black Town took shape discursively in the colonial health reports. In these reports, Victorian notions of hygiene informed the production of native space. Now, health officers disregarded the difference of culture and religion and freely employed textual and visual tropes to produce this knowledge of a Black Town. I will also argue that these representations of space as a culture of pathology targeted the Indian traders with the goal of dismantling the trade networks and then expanded to include all Indian neighborhoods. So the culture was basically a prod, the difference of culture or the idea of a culture of pathology, which I'm mapping onto the space of the Black Town, is something which was produced by this early form of capitalism. Now, in the late 19th century, the Marwari traders who had migrated from Western India, the region that now is Rajasthan, to Eastern India, to take part in this very prosperous South China trade, were targeted in the health reports. Now, in the late 19th century, the Marwari traders controlled the major trade channels of jute and cotton. The portrayal of their neighborhoods as filth-ridden centers of disease called for regulation and demolition. This offered the British the chance to wipe out the biggest competition to their trade and monopolize the trade networks. So in the first half of the paper, I'm going to discuss the methods of selective representation, a tool that empowered the colonial health officers to appropriate Marwari houses, shops, warehouses as the Black Town. In the second half of the paper, I will argue that to resist the state intrusions and the portrayal of Indian neighborhoods as filthy, the Indian property owners fell back on religion to reinvent a Hindu spatial hygiene that challenged the norms of British hygiene. This in turn recast their role in the city above and beyond anything else as Hindu city dwellers. Now, as early as 1803, Lord Wellesley, who was the Governor General of India, had argued that the climate and the faulty infrastructure of Calcutta resulted in filth collecting in the streets. So he was basically blaming the patterns of drainage, the inclination towards the river Ganges as the reason for filth depositing on the city streets. Yet this concern over faulty infrastructure did not inform the later health reports. Instead, the mid-19th century town improvement officers warned the company of dangerous trades and traders living in North Calcutta, where the Indian neighborhoods were concentrated, who threatened the health of the city. For instance, several of these mid-19th century reports point to workmen lacking the knowledge of sanitation who were working in the jute presses of northern India. And when cholera broke out in Calcutta, the health officers expanded on the ideas of dangerous trades to target the Marwaris. They carried out surveys that recorded extraordinary amounts of filth in Marwari neighborhoods. For instance, the health commissioner C.H. Banks, he reported houses that had never been cleaned and streets that had refuse 9 feet high. So these were incredible portrayals of these filth, where the health officer said that he had to climb on a ladder to clean the streets of the Marwari neighborhoods. Now, based on these observations, he shaped a narrative of cholera as local and preventable. Local implied that the disease was confined to the Marwari houses and business centers. Preventable meant that regulation could stop the spread of the disease in these neighborhoods. So in the reports, the insanitation of the Marwari houses accounted for the lightning pace of cholera. Now, in the Marwari neighborhoods, spatial practices were widely different from that of the European cities. So unlike Europe, the business districts were also popular as residential neighborhoods. The shops, the grain stores, and warehouses of Marwaris mixed freely with residential premises, and sometimes they also used to live on the floors above these warehouses. Land prices were high, and Marwari families were large and kept growing with distant relatives, friends, and domestic helps, everybody living together. Now, big families living in expensive plots of land resulted in smaller houses with very little space in between. Additionally, summers in Calcutta are hot and humid, and many Marwaris built their houses in such a way that the windows would be small and the sunlight would not come in that much. Now, the health officers appropriated such building patterns as signs of the Marwaris' inability to order space. They went further to suggest that these dense settlements, or the close packing of houses, threatened the health of the city. Selective representation was one of the key tools that the health officers employed to transform the Marwari neighborhoods into a Black Town. Now, selective representation meant that the health officer seized on occasional instances of filth to argue that this was usual. So in 1876, the health officers reported that cholera was quickly spreading among the Marwari families. So first, they pointed to a Marwari, young Marwari son, Johurmal, as contracting the disease, and then spreading it to the neighborhoods around where he lived. And the health officer concluded that the insanitation of Marwari houses, poor hygienic condition, ill-ventilated, overcrowded rooms that opened into the roadside, mixing smells of sewer gas with house refuse, was spreading the disease. Now, such selective and localized depictions of cholera often took place by silencing the similar narratives of outbreaks in the white town. Cholera, in fact, had broken out in the European parts of the city 5 years before it did in the Marwari neighborhoods. In 1871, a British bureaucrat, Mr. Tracy, had succumbed to it. He, along with his wife, were then living in a boarding house in Calcutta, and they were convalescent, and his health condition deteriorated when the doctor determined that it was indeed cholera. Now, the state had commissioned an inquiry committee to investigate the outbreak of cholera in the White Town. But instead of surveying the boarding house and its environment, the committee carried out a biased investigation from the very beginning, trying to trace the germs to the Indian parts of the city. So after several failed attempts to trace back the disease to the Indian neighborhoods, the committee concluded that although it couldn't settle on the exact roots of the disease, they were definite that the disease was transported from the native town, and this is how the report concluded. Now, immediately after the outbreak of cholera, plague was reported in the city. Now, with this outbreak, the colonial argument that Marwari neighborhoods threatened the health of the city became even more intense. The health officers traced plague to the trade networks of the Marwaris. A 17-year-old boy who had just traveled to Calcutta from Bombay, where plague had happened the year before, was identified with plague. The next victim was 4-year-old Giga, who was the son of a Marwari trader. And the family imported yarn and mangoes from Bombay. So the health officer argued that the Marwari trade routes were bringing in plague from Bombay and called for suspending all the trade networks. Now, similarly, there were instances of anonymous postcards reaching the health officer, which reported this instance of plague in several Marwari houses. And even without verifying these postcards, the health officer called for demolition and suspension of trade routes. Now, additionally, the health officer also produced plague maps to trace the roots of the disease. And for preparing this map, they subjected the Marwari neighborhoods to intense surveillance. The maps went further to suggest that the Marwaris did not simply import plague from Bombay, but that the peculiar patterns of their neighborhoods, the intermix of animals and people, stables and houses, faulty sewers and polluted water, helped the disease to multiply. So this is a plague map which was produced in 1898, which was prepared by a health officer called Neil Cook, and it portrayed this Marwari mohalla or neighborhood as the epicenter of disease. And Cook showed that the plague germinated in the warehouses, in the dwelling houses, and then spread at a very fast pace across the neighborhood. Now, the health officer then concluded that shops, warehouses, and residences of the Marwaris should be inspected and sanitized at once. Houses occupied by all big traders, the Dosarimad Banias and the Modes and Memons, were all forced open to these cleaning gangs. So groups of nearly 200 workers forced their way into these warehouses, dug up the floors, discovered infected rats, and called for closing the warehouses. Now, in Bartala Road, which was the center of Marwari shops, when the commissioners discovered infected rats, they immediately ordered the Marwari traders to to close the grain stores and the warehouses. And while cleaning the warehouses, the cleaning gangs also forced into the houses of the Marwari traders. When the Marwaris protested, the police intervened and cleared away the protesters to make way for these cleansing gangs. Now, in colonial health reports, the importance of the fact that these cleansing gangs had to force their way into the Marwari houses had a second meaning. It meant that the Marwaris were unaware of hygiene, and they were also resistant to being trained in hygiene. So they could not clean these spaces on their own, and that an external agency was required to sanitize these spaces and do the work for them. Additionally, the health reports concluded that that such behavior of resistance was not simply a trait, a character of the ignorant Marwaris, but it was also typical of ignorant Indians. So their reports then described the filth in the houses of the Marwaris as symbolic of Indian unhygiene. Now, photographs further added to the idea of Marwari filthiness. Health Officer Simpson's photographs zoomed into the privies or the toilets of the Marwari houses to show how these leaked, and excreta and filth soaked the grounds near it, polluting the air and producing disease. However, a closer look at these photographs that Health Officer Simpson produced shows a gap between what the photographs, what the image represents, and how Simpson describes it. So the first photograph is something that Simpson used to describe the insanitary condition of toilets in Marwari houses. In this photo, the window marked as one is the privy or the toilet. There is actually very little to suggest that the structure is actually a toilet. It can be seen from the outside, and the inside appears completely dark. The location of the privy inside the house and on an upper story further suggests that the structure might not actually be a privy. Hindu customs required privies to be built outside the house. A small passage usually separated it from the inner quarters that housed the kitchens and the bedrooms. Now, when I looked into these reports of Simpson, I found that he repeatedly points to second-story building, second-story rooms as privies. So, similar to the earlier photo, the next photo also shows the construction of upper-story privies. Simpson argues that the location of these privies, the pipes that carried soiled water, the privy walls were all improperly built. The photo, however, does not explain why he called these structures improper, other than the fact that they were kacha or makeshift. He described that as pipes splashed dirty water on the streets, pools of stagnant, stinking water collected on the grounds below. The photograph, however, does not show this pool of water. Instead, it clearly shows a janitor carrying the filth. So she's here at the corner, and she's carrying the filth, the bucket. She's doing it manually and cleaning the space. Now, Simpson also pointed to verandas, the balconies, as privies. He said that the Indians used their balconies as privies. A receptacle placed below received the excreta. He argued that as verandas had varying heights, the filth often missed its destination and soiled the ground below, yet no such portrayal of filth or stagnant water or soiled earth features in these photos. So there's actually very little evidence in the photos themselves to support what Simpson was otherwise writing in these health reports. Now, in producing the images of a filthy and diseased black town, racial stereotypes were in fact as decisive as the universalizing concerns of hygiene. In 1888, based on these reports, a building commission was commissioned to screen new building plans. And the building commission also started to suggest how houses should be built in the Indian parts of the town. Now, reports of the commission employed a distinct racial language to describe insanitation inherent in Marwari houses. For instance, medical officers came up with proposals to sanitize not only filthy neighborhoods, but through that, the Asiatic race. So the goal was to sanitize the Asiatic race. Medical officer Mr. Brownfield argued that the Asiatic race can improve their cities and houses by following the spatial order of Western cities. So he suggested that houses should be built in a way similar to Philadelphia and Hertford. He argued that houses in Calcutta should be on its own plot of land, resembling miniature villas. To him, Indian houses resembled the Grecian styles, with edifices heavy with massive stupidity. On another occasion, he wrote that Indian houses were hollow squares, enclosing small courtyards with no aesthetic sense at all. Now, all of this discussion was based on these health reports produced by Banks and Simpson. Now, Brownfield, the medical officer who suggested that houses in Calcutta should resemble houses in Philadelphia, he proposed a complete demolition of insanitary Indian neighborhoods. Now, massive demolitions would wipe out the Indians, but also eliminate disease. The first Indian neighborhood that was demolished was a Marwari neighborhood. The health officer described the shops, the entire trade district, as just a simple mixture of gunny bag stores. In the nearby Bonomali Sarkar Street, another Marwari neighborhood, hundreds of huts were demolished. So when the health officer was questioned, he said that so many Indians would be displaced and they would lose their houses. Many of them would lose their ancestral houses, but disease would be eliminated. Now, the work of demolition became very slow when several Indians protested, not only the demolitions, but also the idea of the plague. So they questioned that plague was actually happening in the city, saying that this was a form of tropical fever, which was common even before the British arrived, and that the British were describing it as plague without proper evidence. And several British physicians actually supported this argument that evidence was not enough to call the disease as plague. Now, what the Building Commission also did is that it, in the new building plans that it screened, it did not allow for courtyards, saying that the courtyards were where the filth deposited. And when the Building Commission did not allow for these courtyards, it was actually the tipping point for the Indians. And by tipping point, I mean that it was the moment when active protest against what the Building Commission was doing really started. And what the Indian property owners, led by the Marwaris, did is that they drafted a new language of spatial hygiene, employing religion as the language of resistance, and they demanded that the courtyards should not be covered up because this was a practice which served a religious purpose. And they pointed to sanitary rules dating back to the time of the Hindu King Vikramaditya, saying that the Hindu king wanted the Hindus to have courtyards in their houses. And based on this new idea of a Hindu space, that a house, that an Indian house should necessarily follow the Hindu patterns of building, based on this took shape in a new form of Hindu hygiene. Property owners argued that spatial hygiene should conform to requirements of jat or nation. Religion, as they described, molded the nation. In the case of India, they argued that Hindu religion molded jat, or nation. Christian practices of the West could hardly be of any use in building cities in India because Indian civilization is primarily a Hindu civilization. So in existing scholarship, the idea of India as a Hindu nation has been traced back to the time of anti-colonial nationalism. But what I'm doing here is that I'm pointing to the fact that it was the fight, the conflict over space, the conflict over hygiene, which also produced the idea of a Hindu nation. And it was not necessarily crafted as a response to the fight between the production of nationalism always. So I'm going to just skip over this. So for instance, there was a general consensus among the Indian property owners that the building regulations conflicted the spatial order of Hindu houses and that it should not be followed. A discourse of Hindu vastu, or signs of construction, took shape in the writings of the Indian property owners. And it's interesting how the Indian vastu, which was based on religion, was categorized as a science of building space and houses in these discourses that the property owners produced. So to conclude, what I have argued in this paper is how both the colonial and Indian discourses on space and hygiene appropriated space by investing the built environment with new meanings. Colonialism transformed city space into a terrain of contest between the colonizers and the ruled. The contest was not only over actual control of space, but also over ideas centering space, and also over identities produced with relation to space and hygiene. While the British crafted the Indian neighborhoods as breeding grounds of disease, the Indian property owners responded by making space embody difference and appropriated it to showcase this difference. Thank you.